you know, if connection is something, if human connection fosters ikigai, and Nikon fosters deeper human connection, which it does for many people, then there's definitely a relationship between Nikon as a practice for fostering deeper connection and then consequently fostering a stronger sense of ikigai.
This is Nick Kemp with the Ikigai Podcast, Japanese wisdom for a fulfilling and meaningful life. Find your ikigai at ikigaitribe.com. Hey, it's Nick here. My guest today on episode 48 of the Ikigai Podcast is Dr. Clark Chielsen, an associate professor at the University of Pittsburgh in the Department of Religious Studies. Clark, you specialize in religion in Japan, particularly Buddhism and popular religion, and you teach religion in Asia, religion and culture in East Asia, Japanese religious traditions, popular religion in a changing Japan, as well as Buddhism and psychology. You lived in Japan for over 13 years and studied cultural anthropology there, doing field work at a Zen temple and among secretive Buddhists. And for 5 years, you were the associate editor of Asian Folklore Studies and the Japanese Journal of Religious Studies. So it's great to have you on the podcast. So thank you for your time and for joining me today.
Thanks, Nick. It's great to be with you.
Now, I should point out, you're friends with Greg Kretsch, who I interviewed on episode 9, and also Chikako Ozawa da Silva, who I interviewed on episode 22. So we're in fine company. And yeah, you all share this interest and study Japanese religion, Buddhism, anthropology, Nikon, among other subjects. And I learned so much from Greg and Chikako, so I'm really excited about what we'll talk about on this episode. And I thought, how do we start this episode with all these themes you research? So I thought we'll start with, what attracted you to study religion in Japan and Buddhism?
So I went to Japan just before my 19th birthday. And I went to Japan for the same reason I found a lot of people go to Japan. I went to Japan because it was a long way away from where I grew up. I ran away to Japan. I didn't really have any interests in Japan. I didn't even know, I think, where it was on a map when I decided to go. I just knew it was a long way from Rochester, New York, where I grew up. And so I went to Japan because I had an opportunity. This was the 1986, and I had an opportunity to go through an exchange program at my university. So I went, and then I just stayed. And when I got there, I was interested in the very different religious culture of Japan. So as you know, Nick, most Japanese people say, we're not religious. But yet, you know, people seem to be pretty honest. And so the idea of like religion as necessary for morality just didn't fit with Japan. And I found that interesting. I mean, I remember I was in Japan maybe 1 or 2 months, and I left my wallet in a payphone. Now, people under the age of 35 probably don't even know what payphones look like, but they were, you know, we're in a box, and I was on the phone. I left my wallet on top of the phone in the payphone, and I went back an hour or two later, and the wallet was there. This was in an urban neighborhood. The wallet was there. All the money was in there. So that was, you know, the interest in religion I had as someone who wanted to learn about how do people live. I mean, that was always a question that interested me. And then I just love the earthiness of Japanese Buddhism. So many people who only know Buddhism through English language books think of it as being primarily about meditation and being very philosophical. And that's just not what Buddhism is like in Japan. It's very earthy. It's about the ancestors and ritual and getting things for this worldly benefits. And, you know, that really appealed to me. And it also was a way of, if I'm really honest, it's also a way of, there was a, you know, my parents were divorced and my mom was very much working class, and kind of the non-elite Buddhism of the everyday people.
Yeah, this all sounds familiar. I remember going to Japan and kind of realizing, wow, for a country that has so many shrines and temples, they're not religious people, but they have all these customs and practices. And every time we go back with my wife, we do ohakamari and we go to her mother's grave and clean it. And all these practices seem to ground them or center them. And they seem as, yes, respectful to their ancestors or family members who've passed. And it's certainly nice to have this, I guess it's like a guilt-free kind of religion in some respects. But it is very fascinating and interesting. And then for me also stumbling upon Shintoism, and I haven't really explored that, but that idea that sort of there's these two religions that work together in Japan was also at first bizarre, probably because I was a bit, you know, naive and young and didn't have the patience to learn anything when I first went there. But now it's kind of, yeah, very interesting to explore both these religions and how they gel or work together. But yeah, Japanese don't really talk about these things either. They sort of just practice them and you just observe. Yeah, so 13 years in Japan, that's a long stint. Was that one go or over several trips?
No, that was non-consecutive. So I was there first for about 6.5 years. And so I went as an exchange student. Actually, it was my sophomore year. It's my second year of university. And I only had 1 year in America, and then I went immediately to Japan. So I was still quite young. And that was the boom years of the bubble economy. And so I found good paying part-time jobs and I just wound up staying. And then I wound up going to a Japanese university, Nanzan University, where I studied anthropology, cultural anthropology. And after that, I left. I went to graduate school in the UK, did a master's in religious studies at Lancaster University, and then taught Japanese as a lecturer for a couple of years in Lancaster. And then I went back to Japan, and I was there for another 7 years.
Wow. So you obviously studied the language, and I mean, you never really pick up Japanese because it's quite a hard language to learn. So, I'm assuming you spent quite a bit of time learning how to read and write and speak the language.
Sure. Yeah.
And that's a sort of an ongoing endeavor for me. There's always new words to learn. But what's interesting and something I've never done is spend time at a Zen temple. But you actually did field work at a Zen temple. Right. So what did that involve and what was that experience like?
So, again, this, you know, this interest in kind of folk religion. So when I was an undergraduate in cultural anthropology, we had to do a graduation thesis. And there was a large temple about 45 minutes by train from the university in Nagoya called Toyokawa Inari. And Toyokawa Inari, when people hear that, they think it's a Shinto shrine, because Inari is a deity that's often associated with Shinto. But it's actually one of the three largest Soto Zen training centers in Japan. So it had dozens of novice monks and had dozens of full-time monks. It gets about 5 million visitors a year. Most of them are not coming to meditate, even though it's a training center for priests. And so I just found it really interesting, these two, this kind of very elite Zen also mixing with Japanese folk Buddhism. It was just a fascinating mixture of Zen and its full range of activities and thought. And so I spent time there. The monks there were very kind to me. I remember one time the novice monks, and this is true of other monasteries in Japan as well, but the novice monks used to sneak out of the temple late at night. And one time I snuck out of the temple, and they all used to either wear these hats or wigs when they used to go out drinking in the town. and it was so funny because it was obvious that they were monks, but they put on their hats and wigs. So yeah, that was a lot of fun. But that's what I was doing there. I was doing field work while I was writing my thesis for university.
You got to have a bit of fun when you're writing a thesis, don't you?
Yeah, and I just love the fact that, you know, religion in Japan is also very, it's also full of the ludic, the playful. That's one of the things that I just love about Japanese religion. It's playful. It doesn't have to be all serious.
Yes. Yeah, that is very appealing. Yeah, guilt-free to the point where you can go drinking. So,
Yeah, and there's just, you know, the expectation that, you know, people are flawed.
Yes, which we might touch on later. So I actually need to thank you. I came across your work when I was researching Nikon for my book, and I quote you, reference you in my book, and we'll touch on that a little bit later. But you wrote a paper which is in the Oxford Research Encyclopedia of Religion, Nikon, a Meditation Method and Psychotherapy. Very insightful, and I learned so much from this paper. So I'll link to it in the show notes.
Okay.
And we obviously connected. Mm-hmm. I reached out to you, and we had a few emails. And you suggested that we talk about Nikon and how it relates to the cultivation of Ikigai, which I thought was absolutely perfect. So we'll get into that. But I think we need to touch on what Nikon is. So how would you describe or define Nikon? Hey there, Nick Kemp here, and I wanted to touch base and let you know about my new course, the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. If you are interested in learning more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com. Now back to the episode.
So I would simply describe it as a self-reflection practice, a meditative self-reflection practice that focuses on three questions. What have I received that's positive from other people? What have I given back that's positive to other people? And what troubles and difficulties have I caused other people? And it's the disciplined practice of that, of self-reflection, using those questions, is how I would most simply define Nikon. I would also suggest that it's a type of meditation, in that meditation is about attention regulation, a disciplined attention regulation. So often in mindfulness meditation, this is attention to the breath or body sensations. In other forms of meditation, it could be attention regulation using a mantra, such as the Nembutsu. Where in Nikon, the attention regulation is through those three questions. So it's also a form of meditation.
Yeah, and I think you quote someone saying it's like a way of cleaning the mind.
That's right, absolutely. Yeah. Which is, you know, you talk to Buddhist monks, and that's what meditation is primarily about. It's purification of the mind rather than some attempt to become enlightened, which is just way too far out there for most of us. But, you know, you don't have to be an advanced spiritual practitioner to meditate and have purification of the mind, according to, you know, to most monks.
I mean, this is what's great about it. It's very, very practical and something you can do every day, which we'll touch on. And that leads to, there are two types of Nikon that you write about. And one is, I guess, intensive, or one-week Nikon, and the other is this Nikon journaling. And this is where it all made sense to me, and I shared this on another podcast, but this intensive Nikon was something my wife did when we were engaged, and she was working for this large chain of business hotels in Japan, and she told me, I can't contact you for a week. I've got to do this thing. And yeah, when she told me she had to spend a week in silence and not talk to anyone other than someone who was going to question her on her life, I thought, what is going on? So, yeah, would you like to explain what intensive Nikon is?
Sure. So intensive Nikon is done at a Nikon training center, typically, and the person will spend a week there. So I will talk about this from the first-person perspective. So when I did it for the first time in 2011, I did it in a way that was very common, the way it's normally done, which is I checked in on a Sunday at around 2 o'clock, and I was asked a few questions, and then I was taken back into a room And I was told, first of all, they take your cell phone, your wallet, everything, and they lock it away. So you really don't have any access to anything distracting. And then you're put in a room by yourself and you're sat behind a screen. I was told the three questions, and you start with your mother. I started with my mother. Typically that's where you start. And then for the whole week, you go at that particular place. We woke up at 5 o'clock and we had a cleaning chore for the first half hour. And then pretty much from about 5:30, 6 o'clock to about 9:30 at night, you are just asking yourself those three questions in relation to different people. So it starts typically with the mother from about age six. So you would start Sunday afternoon reflecting on, what did I receive from my mother when I was between the ages of 6 and 8? What did I give back to my mother when I was between the ages of 6 and 8? And what troubles and difficulties did I cause her? And then about 90 minutes later, someone will come in. There'll be like a little ritual of bowing back and forth. And then you will answer those questions very matter-of-factly, very concretely. If you do not answer them concretely, the interviewer might ask you to be more concrete. So sometimes people say, well, my mother was always kind and supportive of me. Kind and supportive is hard to visualize.
Yeah.
It's not too vague. So the idea is to really think of things specific. My mother made me a chocolate cake for my 7th birthday. I can see that. And so you'll have your first interview after about 90 minutes. You'll answer those three questions in relation to your mother. And then you go to the next 3 years in relation to your mother. And about 90 minutes later, you have another interview in which you answer the three questions. You go through life with your mother, you go through your life with your father. And then if you're married, you'll go and do the questions with your spouse. And then often you'll come back to the mother again, because the first few days of doing Nikon, your brain is just all over the place. You know, it's hard to remember stuff. This is boring. You're thinking, what the hell am I doing here? Why am I, you know, I should have thought about this before I signed up for it, you know. And, you know, I was having visions of Vietnam war movies in which, you know, I'm the soldier trapped in this strange environment. So it takes a few days for the mind to settle down. And then once the mind settles down, day 3 or 4, then you really start remembering all kinds of things. And so that's why you then return to your mother and father again. Mm. And then, you know, then the week ends. At the end of the week, sometimes you'll have a discussion with other people who did it for an hour or so, and then people leave, and that's usually it. And there's people who often never do it again. There's no organization you join. No one contacts you. You don't sign up for a mailing list. It's just it. That's how Nikon is usually done in an intensive week. And it is pretty intensive because you're only talking to one other person that whole week. And there's no distractions. And it can get really boring in the beginning.
And what I understand, despite the Mensetsusha being understood as a interviewer, they don't really interview you. They just ask you this question: during this time, what have you been examining yourself on? And then you would just speak for, what, a couple of minutes? Not that long?
Well, yeah, anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes is typical. And actually, if people start going beyond 5 minutes, usually the interviewer will cut people off.
Oh, wow. I was going to say, so it's more about you're spending most of your time reflecting, yeah?
Yeah. And the fact that the interviewer doesn't say anything allows for a greater interiority. So they're another person, but you know that this is not a normal conversation. You know that they're not going to respond to you. And so once you get used to that, it's a very different way of having someone listen to you. Because typically when people are listening to us, they're like responding and they're saying things in response, or, you know, sometimes they're giving affirmations, sometimes they're sharing it. But this is just a total absorption of what you are telling them.
Yeah.
So it's a very different experience.
Certainly sounds like it. And I noted you wrote, and I've read in other papers, that, yeah, the first 3 days there is that resistance and overcoming this discomfort. And but yeah. I guess it would be – actually, out of interest, was that in Japanese or in English when you did that?
That was in Japanese.
Wow. Was that hard for you to articulate your thoughts and express yourself fully?
Not really. And the other thing is once you enter into that mode of psychological space, which is quite distinctive, it's quiet. I mean, it's very quiet, and you're now having this very ritual interaction with an interviewer. The self-consciousness that comes from, am I saying things correctly? Are they understanding me? It kind of just melts away.
Okay.
So that's the other thing. And in some ways, it was difficult to explain some things from childhood, you know, like TV programs. You know, how do you explain that to someone who's, you know, never seen an American TV show? So, but in general, matter of fact, until you asked me that question, I never even thought about it as being like an issue.
Okay. You know?
I do want to say this, though. I also have done a 10-day Vipassana silent retreat. And so sometimes, you know, people say, what's it like, you know, Nikon compared to these 10-day Vipassana retreats, which quite a few people do in the English-speaking world. And I will say that Nikon, even though it's a little shorter, it's 7 days rather than 10, Nikon is much more psychologically demanding. I mean, it was way more. I mean, with Vipassana, I could just sit there and it was physically painful. The Vipassana was physically painful, but, you know, it wasn't psychologically difficult at all.
That's 10 full days in total silence. Here, you don't talk to anyone. And
that's right. It's total silence, but you do listen to a sermon every night. So you are hearing, you know, you do get an hour of listening to somebody. And then if you want to ask questions to the teacher, you can make an appointment to talk to the teacher. And the guy I was with made an appointment every day. He went in and talked to the teacher every day. So, but yeah, typically when I did, I didn't talk to anybody. I talked to the teacher once in the very beginning, and then I didn't talk to anybody for 10 days. Yeah.
Well, but back to Nikon, I guess some listeners might be thinking, you know, why would you do this? So what are the benefits? And I know there's all these applications or a history of the application of Nikon, which is fascinating. So yeah, what are the benefits of doing Nikon?
Right. So it depends on the person. I think when I did Nikon, I did it because I had a graduate student who was a Buddhist monk, and he wrote a paper on Nikon for an independent study with me. And I had known Nikon just by reading about it. And then after he did this independent study, I thought, well, you know, I'll try Nikon. I mean, he was working in the prison and he was using Nikon in the prison here in Pittsburgh. And I was like, wow, he actually learned something useful. Actually, you're in something practical. So I thought, I'm going to try Nikon when I go to Japan. And so that's why I did it. I did it just to try it. And believe me, on the second day, I was thinking, I should not have done this. This was... in my case, I didn't do it for any particular, you know, benefit. But a lot of times people do it. I would say slightly more than half of the people that do it, maybe 60%, is because they're having a serious problem that they could not make progress on doing anything else. It might not be the last resort, but it's pretty close to the last resort for a lot of people. No, I mean, it's a rare person who's suffering from a problem who thinks, oh, I'm going to go do Nikon. And the problems could be various. They could be addiction problems. They could be psychosomatic problems. They could be gambling problems, real difficulties with a child or a spouse. So I'd say about 60% of people do it to solve some specific problem. And then about 30 or so percent of people do it as a form of self-cultivation. They want to be, you know, better at something. So there was a baseball player who did it who, you know, thought it might help with his hitting in Japan. And, you know, managers, company managers do it, you know, because they want to become a better manager. And then the last 10% is a whole mixture of a bunch of different things. So people are looking for some spiritual experience, people who work for a company and the company sent them, and people who work in corrections or jails and the jail sends them, things like that. Mm-hmm. So the benefit's different depending on, but I think if we just had to think, like, what is a common benefit is that people see their lives very differently after doing it, or at least some people do. And as a result of seeing their lives differently, it can change the way they think about who they are that is conducive to reducing suffering. But it rarely, it's, you know, the illusion is that you have an intense experience and you're changed forever. You know, people are much more complicated than that. So it's like seeing something. For me, it was more like seeing something that could not be unseen. And to that extent, it stuck with me, and it sticks with other people as well. You know what I mean? So in that way, I thought, oh, this is really interesting. I want to study this more.
Yeah, I mean, you write that it also can help people overcome addiction. So drugs and alcohol help with insomnia. And you mentioned it was used in Japan's prison system. It reduces recidivism. So it seems to have these benefits. And you think, wow, a week of this intense Nikon and then maybe practicing daily Nikon.
Yeah.
And you do see yourself and your life experiences and your connections to all these significant others in a different, intense, I guess, clear light or more clarity.
Yeah.
Something people probably never do. You'd never spend a week reflecting on these important relationships and think about what have I received, what have I given back, and what troubles have I caused. So we'll move on to daily. And that's obviously a far less intensive experience. So what's daily Nikon?
Right. So let me just add before I get into daily Nikon.
Sure.
This is a simple way to think about the benefits of Nikon. Before I did intensive Nikon, I used to think like, oh, life is not fair. You know, like life is not fair. And, you know, my mother used to say, you know, life is not fair. And I used to think that was bad. And then after doing Nikon, I also thought life was not fair. And I was glad that life was not fair because, you know, the fact that life is not fair means that I have a much better life than my life would be if everything were fair. So it was that kind of shift. Now, again, that going to daily Nikon, the idea is that after you do intensive Nikon, that you will then continue to practice doing daily Nikon. Almost nobody ever does, frankly. The truth of the matter is that very, very few people actually go on and practice daily Nikon. But the way it is done is you would reflect. It can be done in lots of different ways, but it would be done as a daily practice at whatever time it suits you. And you would reflect on the three questions. The way that the founder recommended be done on a daily basis is that you would spend half your time reflecting on the previous day, what you received from people on the previous day, what you gave back to people on the previous day, and what troubles and difficulties you caused people on the previous day. So you'd spend half your time reflecting on the previous 24 hours. And then you spend the other half of your time looking back further in your life in relation to a particular person. So, you know, what did I receive from my sister when I was between the ages of 12 and 14? What did I give back to my sister when I was between the ages of 12 and 15? 14, and what troubles and difficulties did I cause? Some people write it in a journal. They write their answers out in a journal. Some people just do it in their head, and which is more difficult, but it can also be more powerful because you're not distracted by the writing process. So that's how it's done. There's other ways to do it, and I'm just going to add one other way. And this is a way that I think is easiest for many people to do it. And that is just, you just do the first question. So there's something in Nikon called, it's called yokata sagashi. And yokata sagashi is you just look for the good things. You know, you're just, yokata is like the good things that happened. And sagashi is to look for. And so you're just looking for the good things that happened in the previous day. And that actually is pretty easy to do. It's not as labor intensive as the three questions. And so it's much easier for people to do that over a sustained period of time.
Well, certainly avoids the third question, which really, I think, challenges Westerners.
Sure.
And yeah. I've witnessed a bit of concern and a lot of resistance to this question.
Ooh.
A few things that have been expressed to me was it could make vulnerable people who are in an abusive relationship actually believe or feel that they're a bad person. I think some people misunderstand it, that it's sort of creating this sense of guilt. And then it's quite hard for people to honestly answer. I've seen some people sort of answer it kind of as, okay, I did do something wrong, but it was justifiable. So, and it almost makes me think of my, you know, my young teenage self thinking, me? I haven't done anything wrong. I don't cause trouble for anyone. So you probably need a bit of life experience, a bit of wisdom to think, oh, yeah, I've got my flaws and I do cause trouble and I can acknowledge that.
Yes.
So, yeah, what are your thoughts on this resistance to the third question?
So I think the resistance is often more in the conceptual rather than in the practice. So when people hear it, they're often like, wow, why would anyone do that? But often if someone asks me to, you know, lead people in Nikon, you know, I'll have certain occasions where that's done. I just have people do the three questions on their best friend. I usually start with their best. You start with Nikon, you always start with the easiest people. And the idea is that Yoshimoto Isshin thought that the mother was the easiest person, which is not, obviously, is not always true. But in general, particularly if you're not in an intensive Nikon situation, you're just doing daily Nikon, you start with the easiest person. So pick the person that you have the best, most nourishing relationship with, right? And then if you just say, you know, think about what you've received from the person over the past week, what have you given to that person over the past week in return? And what troubles and difficulties did you cause the person? Just get them to do it, usually a few minutes on each one. There's rarely much resistance to the third question. If you talk about it as like an abstract activity that other people do, then it sounds like, oh, that's just going to make people feel bad. And in general, it doesn't, because the three questions are kind of like a tripod. You know, if you just do two of them, it's going to be unsteady. But with the three questions working together, they work together in a way that's complementary. And so if we realize how we cause other people troubles and difficulties, yet we also see how they have given to us and how we have given back to them, despite those troubles and difficulties, we see the strength and the caring in the relationship that is not going to be as clear if we do not recognize that we also cause other people trouble and difficulties. It's the nature of social life in that we as human beings, we cause each other troubles and difficulties. And there's no avoiding that. And if a person thinks that they are not causing other people troubles and difficulties, they're probably missing out on the extent to which people actually care about them, despite the fact that they're not perfect.
I've read that somewhere else, and that acknowledgement indicates that if you do feel a sense of guilt when you do realize I've caused trouble, it already means the people who care about you have like forgiven you anyway. So there's no need to feel guilty when you do this activity or this Nikon exercise or something along those lines. Yeah.
So typically, many people in the English language world have a real problem with guilt. And it's in part because they have a very specific understanding of what guilt is. And guilt is a complex emotion that can be driven by different mental vectors. And so I just want to outline two types of guilt that I think are important to distinguish when it comes to thinking about guilt and Nikon in relation to guilt. Nikon will make people feel guilty. There's no doubt about it. In some ways, if it is making people feel guilty, this is usually a good sign. But here's the important thing to realize. Most people think of guilt in the sense of being a very self-centered type of guilt. In other words, guilt about being, I'm bad. It's about me and I should be a better person. And that was terrible of me. And it's very self-centered. A very self-centered guilt is destructive. That's bad guilt. That is not a healthy, constructive type of guilt. But there's another type of guilt, which is other person-centered, which can be healthy because it's a guilt that says, I want to repair that relationship. I hurt this other person. I was not kind to that other person in that situation. Mm-hmm. I could have done better. I should have done better. And now I want to do something about it. And so the guilt is not focused on me and how I'm a bad person. The guilt is focused on the pain and suffering of the other person. And so therefore instills a motivation to want to repair that relationship. And that is a healthier form of guilt. unfortunately, most people only think about guilt as the first type, and it's in part because we're naturally selfish.
Well, I think that's a significant distinction, and that actually reminds me of this expression, meiwa kukake naide, in Japanese, that I remember learning. And it translates to, you know, don't cause trouble for others. So Japanese are very aware of not causing trouble to others. And I share a story on another episode where I was shocked that this father's parting greeting to his three-year-old daughter at kindergarten would be meiwa kukake naide, don't cause trouble today. Whereas I was sort of cuddling my son and I love you, and I was stunned. But it sort of took me a few conversations with my wife and other people to realize he was just sort of saying, you know, be a good girl today. And yeah, so that idea of the guilt where you've caused trouble others, I mean, you've caused trouble to others, you'd want to repair that or fix that or make peace with that so you could move on. I think makes sense rather than thinking I'm a bad, evil person or something. That totally makes sense.
And wouldn't we like it if people realize the trouble that they cause us? Wouldn't we like that?
We do love it.
Yeah, I mean, so why don't we be willing to give other people that gift?
I agree totally. It's funny you mentioned that because I remember Chikako Ozawa da Silva on a video when she was explaining Nikon said, you know, this idea of a fourth question, do you think about the troubles and difficulties that other people cause you? You know, why isn't there a fourth question? And she sort of said, you know, we're already experts on this question because we're probably thinking about it at least once or twice a day that someone's caused us trouble. So we don't need to reflect on that. So that's kind of interesting. But when I shared Nikon with my community, one member, a good friend of mine, Dorothy Dalton, and I'll give her a shout out, she said she wondered if it would be helpful to add a fourth question, like, what did I learn? And I've also thought along the lines of, how could I do things better in the future, especially in relation to question three? So are these questions or chain of thought sort of implied in the third question?
Listen, those are good questions. Those are good self-reflection questions. You know, there's lots of ways that we can do self-reflection. And, you know, before Yoshimoto developed the three questions, there were lots of other questions that he used as well. I think that the discipline of focusing on the three questions has merit, the simplicity of that. And trying to add more can just make things more complicated and actually dilute the process. It can start making it a more cerebral process and less an emotional art process. The other thing is, I think it's a mistake, and I think this is most Nikon practitioners would say, you know, Nikon shouldn't be used to try to coerce a particular state of mind.
Okay.
The idea of trying to coerce a feeling. So sometimes people say, well, if I do that, am I going to feel grateful? And I say, well, you might or you might not. You know, I was once doing in Japan after I did Nikon a couple of times, I asked if I could go around as an interviewer and the guy said, sure. And so I was an interviewer for a week. And one woman who was having had a really very traumatic, you know, life, just some really terrible things happened to her. And she said, do I have to feel grateful? She was asking me, it was the beginning of the week. And I was like, oh my gosh, I'm just doing this. I'm like, what should I say? You know, am I supposed to say anything? And I said, well, you don't have to. You know, that's not the purpose of Nikon, is to do the Nikon. It's not to make you feel anything in particular. And I think sometimes people try to use a discipline, whether it's a certain type of meditation or other practice, and they try to coerce their mental activity into feeling good. And Nikon is not best done that way. Nikon is best done, you just do it. And what will happen. But trying to coerce ourselves into feeling good is a recipe for feeling bad.
That does make sense. I mean, I've thought out loud that is it a practice that is, in a way, you know, self-actualizing? Do you because you spend time reflecting on these questions and you're honest with yourself, does it help you self-actualize? Or is it just a sort of an intrinsically motivating activity that you do every day just to clear your mind or clean your mind? Assuming you do it every day. You don't have to do it every day.
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there's advantages to being aware of ourselves and our lives. And that may be pleasant or it may be unpleasant, or it, you know, it's not going to necessarily induce good feelings. And that's where the discipline comes in. And that's where we start to live deeper lives. If our lives are focused on feelings and the pursuit of feelings, we're always going to wind up being dissatisfied. I mean, that's like the core kind of Buddhist perspective on the nature of life. So, you know, I would say the same with that. The process of doing Nikon, you become more aware of yourself, become more aware of your life, and that often generates feelings of gratitude or awe. And sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you remember stuff that makes you angry, and you remember stuff that makes you feel resentful. So it's not just a magic practice to make people feel good. I think to use it as such is just an overly consumerist way of trying to engage in the practice.
Yeah, you've reminded me of that word, arugamama, where you understand the true nature of things. It can be interpreted as acceptance, but I understand it as you sort of just have this understanding. Life is the true nature of things. Good, bad things happen. We can have feelings about them, but we've got to move past the feelings eventually if they're pleasant or unpleasant. So this is probably where we should now we're going a bit deeper, move to ikigai and how Nikon can cultivate more ikigai. And this was your suggestion. So I really appreciate this suggestion. So, yeah, what are your thoughts? Can Nikon help us cultivate more ikigai in our lives?
Right. So I proposed the question in part because I wanted to just explore it rather than because I had some specific answer I wanted to share. But I suppose that the reason why I want to explore it is because I have a concern that people feel that they either have an ikigai or they don't, or that they're searching for it, like they're going to magically find it somewhere, yeah. And they don't. And it's almost a way of trying to chase a dream life. Like if I could just find the right job, if I could just find the right romantic partner, you know, if I could just find my ikigai, my life will be fantastic. Yeah. And I think that for many people, you know, it's a pointless activity. They're not going to find it just by looking around.
I mean, that's sort of articulated in the Western Venn diagram. Like it's right. This sweet spot of these four things of doing your love, that you're good at, that the world needs, and that you can be paid for. And I mean, for most people, that's it's probably unattainable, really. So even that phrase, find your ikigai, I think it's something like uncover is better because it's there. You just probably haven't given it time. And so maybe Nikon helps you uncover it.
And this is what I don't know, but I'm interested in thinking about, is can you construct an ikigai based on habits and practices, and then at some stage you realize, oh, you know, as a result of doing that, I now feel a sense of ikigai. And, you know, I suspect that you can, although I haven't come across a lot of kind of ikigai practice work. I've come across, like, you know, this is how you can find it. You know, this is what it is. I mean, your book does a very nice job of explaining kind of all the different facets of what can be involved with ikigai. And I was just thinking, like, you know, how might we live in a way that can cultivate ikigai, create it, such as living a grateful life? I mean, gratitude is a feeling, but you can do certain things in which gratitude starts to happen more frequently. The way you start thinking about those certain practices will lead to a greater sense of gratitude. And that doesn't necessarily mean making a gratitude list. That can just be noticing other things. So, you know, I suspect in this way, I see Nikon as related to cultivating ikigai is that when I realize, when I feel like people have done something for me, I just naturally want to give back to them. That's, I think, true for most people. You know, if once you feel like someone has done something very good to you, you want to do something, not out of obligation, just because you feel grateful to them. And so I think in that way, Nikon relates to ikigai, in that, you know, I'm so fortunate to have had this, been taken care of by so many people in my life, that I want to take care of other people. You know, I want to give back. And when we're in that state of mind, I, and I think other people, definitely feel a, you know, a sense of ikigai.
Well, that does make sense, I think, for a few reasons. So that expression you used before, yokata sagashi, this idea of acknowledging these good things, could be these sources of ikigai in your life. And if we look at how Ken Moggi defines the concept as the accumulation of all these things in your life, he talks about how ikigai is like proactive. Like if you're proactive and you do things that you enjoy, things that give you sensory pleasure, you can have this spectrum of ikigai. And I guess you could be grateful and recognize perhaps the people involved in those small things and realize, wow, most of these things I enjoy or I appreciate or I love come from someone else. And I guess, you could definitely relate that to the first question. You know, what have I received? And it could be not just people, it could be from, you know, the planet, the good weather, the nature. So I do think there would be a link between gratitude, acknowledging what you have that is life-affirming, that does make you feel it is good to feel alive, or my life is a little bit better now because of this meal I've had with a friend, or because a friend called me and checked in with me. And you could have all those feelings of life satisfaction. You know, you feel connected, you feel that resonance with people. So yeah, maybe your idea of just focusing on the first question is quite helpful rather than sort of dealing with the two others.
Yeah, well, it's certainly easier. And again, I have, you know, it's the question which is most salient to me at this moment rather than an answer, which is just, you know, how can we cultivate a meaningful life? And rather than look for one, because I think the looking for one just leaves a lot of people lost.
I agree.
And so if we could think of ways to cultivate meaning in life, a profound, deep meaning in life, then it would give people a path to not just find, but to create a meaningful life.
I think that's the key word, create. And it always seems to tie to a social context. Like, I think what I'm doing today with you, it is a source of ikigai, you know, researching, reading your paper, reaching out to you, establishing a connection, and now having the conversation. We're having a meaningful conversation. It's kind of like an intellectual form of intimacy. And I really appreciate your time and the paper you wrote and the love and effort you put into the paper. And yeah, years from now, I'll have this positive memory that I can reflect on and think, oh, that was a great conversation I had with Clark. And yeah, you end up creating it by learning and sharing. And it's all seems to be involving, not always, but involving others. So I think one way to do it is to learn, to share, to connect with others for cultivating a meaningful life.
Yeah. I mean, in your book, you mentioned community and the relationship between community and ikigai, right? And that, I think there's a real close connection between that idea and Nikon. I mean, Nikon is in relation to one's community to a large degree. And that means very often a very intimate community of our families, but, you know, beyond that as well. And so to think about how can we cultivate our relationship with a community, that can lead to a sense of ikigai. So I guess my point is this, in terms of why I think this question is important, is so many people would like to have ikigai and they just don't. And you know, Chikako, I'm sure, talked about this. It's kind of a despondency in Japan.
Yeah.
And that despondency and loneliness is not just Japan. Just think of the, you know, I teach at a university. The level of mental health among young people in the United States right now, and I suspect throughout much of the developed world, it's bad. It's really bad. People don't feel like their lives are meaningful. And to tell them, like, well, look for meaning in your life, that's too vague. It's too difficult. And then, or even worse, the danger is they look for meaning and they find none, and they're like, it's pointless. So rather than just tell people to find your, you know, to find it, which is really hard, it might be better to give people things that they can do, which will consequently result in it.
I agree totally. Yeah. I mean, that's why in some part why I try to place a strong emphasis on who is your ikigai rather than what, to sort of suggest it is people and relationships that ultimately matter most. And there might be some exceptions. A good one actually was my father. I think he preferred not having, as bizarre as this will sound, no friends, and he was quite satisfied with one significant other, his wife or his second wife. So yeah, my parents divorced too. And so I think that's something we're missing now. We're focused on external or extrinsic success, or we're trying to find this answer to a very important question in external or extrinsic things, success, money, wealth, appearance. And we all know they're very limiting in giving us a sense of satisfaction, yet we continually pursue them and we're kind of encouraged to. And when we talk about community, people aren't involved in community anymore, like very few. And if they are, it's limited to perhaps only things they care about, which is good, but also it probably doesn't give you opportunity or exposure for you to grow to different opinions, different cultures, different ways of thinking. I mean, it's the reason in my book why I introduced all these other words like osobigai, which, yes, you know, Japanese don't really use, but what things are worth playing, or what plays worth engaging in? Manabigai, learning. And we all have this opportunity to teach, you know, oshiegai. So I think you find it in, yes, Ken kind of said, in doing things that are meaningful, tied to a social context, rather than, if I could earn $500,000 a year, my life would be perfect. I'd have enough money to do everything and buy everything. And then you're focused on that challenge of trying to earn a certain income, thinking it's going to give you this lifestyle, when you could probably have the lifestyle you want now if you just were proactive and focused on people. And yeah, maybe doing a bit of Nikon as well.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way the world largely works as I see it today is there's a lot of emphasis on the individual.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of emphasis on the individual trying to make themselves feel good. And the ways that people try to do that are often not conducive to their well-being. And they try to make themselves feel good by just being around people who they like being around, or you know, doing things that make them feel good. Like when you ask people about, you know, there's this concept that's really kind of taken off called self-care, right?
Mm.
And when I ask students, like, you know, because my students are much younger than me, I ask students, what does self-care entail? Like, what are your self-care strategies? And almost everything they tell me is like things they're going to do by themselves, right? I'm going to take a bath. I'm going to take a nap. I'm going to, you know, buy myself some really nice shoes or something. And so they come up with all these activities which are very self-focused. And I think, like, well, maybe one way we can do better self-care is by being with other people in richer ways.
That really speaks to me. The other day on a Twitter thread that got a lot of comments, it was this theme of, you know, self-reliance and the power of being independent. And I was getting all this positive responses, and I was pretty tempted to say, you know, hang on, we're not as independent as we like to believe we are. And we're very much dependent on the service or help of other people. And to sort of to pride ourselves on being, I can do it all by myself. I don't need help. And I'm not sure there's some positivity to that. We should be self-reliant. But I actually love the Japanese word for self, or they have many words for self, but that word jibun, where you realize from the kanji, you're a self, but you're a part. And you are a part of a community or a neighborhood, a community, a country, the world. And that, yeah, we're trying, as you pointed out, to be by ourselves, thinking that's the answer to our problems. And just the other day, like 5 days ago, I went to Toastmasters for the first time. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, I'm being a bit vulnerable. I'm exposing myself to something new. Met all these people. Had a fantastic time, and I can't wait to go back in 2 weeks. And didn't cost any money. I didn't have to really do anything other than walk in a room and start talking to people and start, you know, learning something new. And that was probably the highlight of my week, you know. So I think you're right. We need to spend time with more people, and people maybe we don't know, new people. Yeah.
I mean, the sense of connection usually gives people a sense of meaning. Mm. And so connecting with other people, I think, is really fundamental, even if it's only one other person, as in the case of your father. And I suspect that he may have had other relationships through work, even if they were not friends. But certainly we have to take care of other people through work and other things. But that connecting with other people is fundamental to living meaningful life. And if we feel like we're not connected with other people, if the only reason we're living for is to kind of feed our desires, mm-hmm. we're going to feel pretty lonely pretty quickly. And a sense of meaning, there's just not much meaning in that.
I agree totally. I mean, I think that is my ikigai, connecting with other people. You learn so much from other people. You end up learning, I think, about yourself through other people, and you grow. I think there's limited growth in these other pursuits we deem so important. Because I think I write in the book that I kind of defined ikigai. One way to understand it is this intimacy. You know, we have all these types of intimacy, intellectual, social, creative, spiritual, obviously physical. And it does mean you're connecting to someone and sharing something. So this shared experience obviously matters. And I guess that's why we can see and talk and listen. So we're sort of designed to do that, to engage with someone else. Yet most people are engaging with devices and technology.
Yeah, screen. Anyway, I mean, this is, you know, if connection is something, if human connection fosters ikigai and Nikon fosters deeper human connection, which it does for many people, then there's definitely a relationship between Nikon as a practice for fostering deeper connection and then consequently fostering a stronger sense of ikigai.
Couldn't agree more. So maybe that's the takeaway, I think, or the key takeaway from this podcast. So that really goes back to, does that then go back to really appreciating and acknowledging and wanting to give back to all these people in your life?
Yeah, but again, you can't force it. Mm. If it happens, it happens. I mean, and if it doesn't, you know, you it's fine. You can learn other things, you know. One thing that you can learn by doing Nikon is how your mind just works in particular ways. Mm. Like you're doing Nikon, you're trying to remember what you received from somebody. And the first thing, all you can think about is the time they insulted you in front of, you know, your best friend or whatever. And, you know, and so then you realize, oh, this is how my mind works. My mind gravitates towards hurtful things.
Yes.
And so you become aware of how your mind can cause you pain and cut you off from people. And that has value too.
But let's move on to you with a question. What would you say is some of your ikigai? Because you can obviously have more than one.
I typically, I'm going to be frank, Nick, I typically don't ask myself this question. And I think that when I don't feel the urge to ask the question, I probably have the greatest sense of ikigai.
Nice.
And, you know what I mean? It's like when I'm happy, I don't think about how happy I am. You know, or maybe occasionally I do, but I'm just like, I'm living life and I feel like, oh, this is nice. So I typically don't ask myself, you know, what my ikigai is. I will say this, however, I feel incredibly fortunate. And because I am very fortunate. And I think that being able to just, you know, live, and this is going to sound a little bit too dramatic maybe, but the fact that, you know, we're here for this, we're here for this very limited time. I mean, we're kind of like being just being alive is kind of like living in a mystery. It's kind of magical. And it's very ephemeral. You know, billions of years existed before we had human consciousness, as far as we know, before we were a person. And billions of years are going to go on after us. And we got this little space to be alive. It's just like, this is magical.
Yeah.
This is magical. And to just live in the magic of life. And, you know, sometimes I just feel like I do feel incredibly fortunate and lucky. And I think, like, it's going to sound ridiculous, but what's there not to love about being alive? You know what I mean? I get that there's pain, but a lot of times I just feel like it's great just to be alive and healthy and have this life.
I mean, that could be a very powerful activity to reflect on the odds of you being alive and how all these people had to meet going back generation, for you now to be alive. And then for life to exist and going back billions of years. So, yeah, it is the ultimate jackpot that we're alive. And, yeah, I think being present to that. And I do like that idea that if you're not thinking about ikigai, it probably means you're expressing it or living it or appreciating it. So it's not something we have to take too seriously as well. We can just go out, enjoy our friendships, our hobbies, and we don't have to be chasing the dream.
Yeah, somebody said all the TED Talks on happiness are basically giving the same message. I have not verified whether this is true or not, but the person said happiness is the product of living well. It is not realized by chasing it.
Mm.
In other words, if you chase after happiness, you're not going to find it. You're just going to be dissatisfied. And that, I think, conceptually, that's true. I mean, if I'm asking myself how happy I am, I'm usually like, I'm pretty happy, but I could be happier.
That's true.
But when I'm just living and I just think like, wow, this is amazing. This is amazing that I get to have this life and I've been incredibly fortunate, you know.
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, I feel the same way. I feel like, how lucky are we to have this conversation? And we're not limited by, you know, if we tried to do this 30 years ago, 40 years ago, it probably would be far difficult. Phone call or maybe if it was 100 years ago, it wouldn't be happening. So, yeah, we have so much to be thankful for and to enjoy and to experience without a sense of pressure. You know, we can just be present and enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of the things I love about Japan, at least my experience, is that, listen, there's 127 million Japanese people. There's lots of different Japanese people. But you will find in Japan this idea of the magic in the mundane.
Yeah.
Like just the mundane life is where the good life is. Like to be heibon de shiwase, like just to be normal, just have a normal life is a happy life. And I think that's a fantastic lesson that I have learned from my years of being in Japan. It's like just it's in the mundane that we find the magic.
So many lessons, aren't there, from Japan? I think one of my key takeaways was chanto suru, just do things properly as well. But you're right, the heibon, the Japanese are really good at finding, I don't know, they find something in the normal. And I guess it goes back to them. I just assume that they're far more present than Australians are. I'll sort of speak for Australians. And I remember the first few times I ate with friends in Japan, the glee on their face. They really enjoyed their ramen or this slither of cheesecake, where I'm thinking, oh, you know, that's not enough. I'll need a second slice, you know. So I've certainly learned a lot too. I should ask one final question. Do you practice Nikan every day?
Well, typically I practice the first question most mornings. I do practice, and just kind of out of habit, I do the other three at different, you know, just living my life. But typically the more in a disciplined way, I mostly just do the Yokata Sakashi. So every morning, I typically, when I'm waiting for the coffee to brew, so I get up and I make coffee. And so I got about a 10-minute window of just waiting for that. And during that 10-minute window of waiting for the coffee to brew, I think about the previous day and the good things that happened in the previous day. So I've been doing, that's a pretty regular practice. Yeah.
Nice. One more question. How many intensive Nikans have you done?
Five.
Oh, five. Gee. Wow. Any plans to do another?
No, not right now. I'm just trying to get to Japan again. I would just love to go back. I mean, we've been locked out because of COVID.
Yeah.
I mean, we can get back now, but because of work and things, I can't go now. But I hope to go next summer. But I don't know if I'll do another Nikon retreat next summer. Yeah.
Wow, Clark, I learned so much from your paper and from our conversation today. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Nick. It was a pleasure.
Likewise. Thanks, mate. This episode was brought to you by the Find Your Ikigai course. Developed in consultation with Japan's leading Ikigai researchers, the Find Your Ikigai course is the only culturally accurate and evidence-based practical guide to the Ikigai concept. To learn more about the Find Your Ikigai course, please visit ikigaitribe.com.